Welcome to Making Change, a podcast of the Chronicle of Philanthropy. I'm Hilde Gottlieb, author of The Pollyanna Principles and co-founder of Creating the Future, a living laboratory for accelerating social change. It is my privilege to host this podcast, where we talk with change leaders from around the world about this sector's potential for creating visionary social change. I'm so pleased to welcome Tanya Sermon as my guest on Making Change. Tanya's experience spans two decades of bringing groups together to create social change. Most recently, Tanya's passion for network building has resulted in her founding the Center for Social Innovation in Toronto, a shared workspace that builds relationships among social mission organizations, creating the conditions for social innovation to emerge. In addition to her full-time job leading the charge at CSI, Tanya's network building focus can also be seen in her position as co-chair of the Ontario Nonprofit Network. Given her passion for connecting changemakers, helping them reach for their potential to create the future of our world, it's my pleasure to have Tanya Sermon share her observations with us today here on Making Change. My guest today on Making Change is Tanya Sermon. She is the Executive Director of the Center for Social Innovation in Toronto. Welcome, Tanya.
Hi.
Before we get going, if you could tell our listeners just a little bit about the path that brought you to your work and a little bit about the Center for Social Innovation.
Sure. Well, maybe I'll start with what the Center for Social Innovation is and then tell you a little bit about my background. So what we do is we provide shared space and services, the space, the relationships, and the knowledge to support social innovation and the social entrepreneurs which drive social innovation. So what we have is we start with two locations here in Toronto, and we provide support to over 350 social mission organizations, and that represents about 800 social entrepreneurs in our two spaces. So the idea is that we start with physical space, and then we animate the connections and collaborations amongst our members with the idea of creating the conditions for social innovation emergence. And so we'll dig into what that exactly looks like. But CSI is really, you know, my latest experiment. The work that I've been doing for the last 20 years is around collaboration and around building social capital and community for social change. And specifically, the work that I had done prior to the CSI was with a group called the Canadian Partnership for Children's Health and Environment. This was a multi-sectoral partnership working with children, health, and environment groups to look at toxics and children's health issues. And we were one of the partnerships that was instrumental in getting the ban in bisphenol A in baby bottles back in 2008, which then subsequently triggered a market transformation and really kind of set a precedent at a global level for how we can protect children and, by extension, all human beings from the exposures of plastics.
Wow.
Before KPCHI, which we call the Canadian Partnership for Children's Health, I had the pleasure of working on a number of different projects, from co-founding a alternative news website to being instrumental in introducing the internet into the not-for-profit and social mission sector here in Canada, and have been involved in everything from starting cooperative daycares to street parties to community gardens. Everything that you can imagine, all the way from on-the-ground community-based activities all the way to much more institution building, to the point now where I'm, in addition to running the Center for Social Innovation, I'm also the co-chair of the Ontario Nonprofit Network, which is a network that serves over 40,000 not-for-profit organizations in the province of Ontario, working to build stronger voice in relationship to government and to build agency amongst our sector.
Wow. It is from that vast experience and depth of observing social change over time that I'm just so excited to be able to ask you the question that I ask all of my guests. When you see change happening, whether it is happening at the children's health level, whether it's happening where you see it in the Center for Social Innovation, when you see change happening, significant change that you can feel and touch, what do you see really going on that's bringing that change about?
And I just love that question. I'm a very pragmatic, practical person, but at the meta level, I'm challenged by this question of exactly what you're asking. How does change happen? What motivates it? What moves it forward? So it's interesting. It's the field of social innovation. And my experience and what I've sort of been led to believe is that it takes a really good threat or opportunity to drive change. Mm. Some of the work that I was doing when I was with the Partnership on Children's Health was on experimenting with a new governance model that we call the Constellation Model. Now, this is a partnership model that the group of us at KPCHE co-created, which was really looking at how do we balance power within multi-sectoral partnerships that are actually going to facilitate real change on the ground. And fundamental to our sort of theory is this concept of a magnetic attractor. So you ask, you know, when you see significant change happening, what is it that we're seeing? And I would argue that what we're seeing is people and ideas and organizations responding to a magnetic attractor. That magnetic attractor could be a threat. It could be a change in legislation that mobilizes a community to take action around a policy shift. It could be the threat of climate change or of toxic exposure or whatever that issue that has affected people. But it also can be an opportunity. It could be a change in landscape. So in Ontario, we have something called the Green Energy Act, which is a piece of legislation which has magnetized the creation of a very active solar industry. And so why this is important is because a magnetic attractor alters an ecosystem and it reignites action on the part of the people and organizations in that ecosystem. So when we start to look at how change happens, one of the most interesting questions is not how is this affecting me in my work, but rather how is this change, this threat or opportunity affecting the myriad of different players within that ecosystem and who sees themselves responding to that threat or opportunity and what potential partnerships and new alliances might be built to help us to facilitate a more intentional change for the good in the world. So I can give you an example.
I'd love that.
So for us, the one that I can explain perhaps most clearly and most interesting, most recent is with the Ontario Nonprofit Network I mentioned in my opening. And it was really interesting. The founder of that network, Lynn Eakin, came to a group of nonprofit leaders in Ontario and said, you know, we need to be more proactive and we need to work together in the sector. And so she went and she took this recognition of the fact that we didn't have a provincial voice. We didn't have a relationship with the government. Here we were, a million employees, 40,000 organizations strong. We represent 7% of the gross domestic product as a sector, but we have no voice in government. And she went around and she consulted a bunch of people. And all of us basically came back to her and we said, you know, Lynn, great stuff. Love what you're doing. But this is a nice to have, not a need to have. Mm-hmm. And we all went back about our work. Mm-hmm. And what was interesting was then about 6 months after she went around and talked to different folks, I got an email message from the government of Ontario that basically said that they were updating the Ontario nonprofit legal framework. And one of their recommendations is that any nonprofit organization that generated over 35% of its own revenue would be forced to become a for-profit.
Whoa.
Whoa is right. So here we were. We had a perfect threat.
Wow.
We had this magnetic attractor, which was a threat from the government of Ontario, which subsequently spurred and stimulated a recognition in the not-for-profit sector that we needed to work together to be able to respond to threats and opportunities through the government of Ontario. And that was 5.5 years ago now. And in fact, now we're a membership of over 6,000 organizations across the province. We've got a very strong relationship with the provincial government, and we're influential in change after change after policy change. And it all came together because we intentionally recognized this threat as an opportunity to galvanize an ecosystem in a new way. And this has become a critical driver for change in the not-for-profit sector. It's just an interesting example of a threat being a wonderful opportunity to get organized.
Well, it sounds like what you did was instead of simply reacting to the threat, which you did,
yeah,
you made it something bigger. You looked at what reacting to that threat would make possible in the bigger picture of something positive. So you built off of what some would have seen a one-off effort to, okay, we responded, we got that done, we're out of here. You springboarded from there to something positive, that you're not staying where it's negative and thready. You're moving it up to what's possible.
It's exactly what we were doing. And we formed a steering committee very, very quickly. And we did this very intentionally. We said, what we're going to do is we're going to take this threat and we're going to leverage this threat to create this network, because those of us who are thinking long term recognize there will be threat after threat and opportunity after opportunity, and it's up to us to take action. But what we did is we very intentionally used this threat as a way to create a network. But I think it's a couple things here. I think one, we were thinking like an ecosystem. We were not just looking at how this threat affects just our own individual organization. We were looking around and we were looking at the entire ecosystem, and we were making strategic choices based on that ecosystem analysis. This is a key strategy. The question was, when you see significant change happening, what factors do you see causing or supporting that change? And so my question is one much more of agency, which is, how do we become more intentional about facilitating the change we want to see in the world? And this is the process of recognizing that, for me at least, that most people do want to be a part of the solution.
Right.
And it's up to us to bring our macro brains to the process of change and to engage new and different partners in that change process. So what we did with ONN is we went into the government of Ontario and we said, look, hey, you guys who are threatening us in this way, we actually think that we can offer you quite a bit of help in facilitating the introduction of this new legislation. Let's work together to figure out what that change might look like. And here, let us show you the kind of excellence that we can offer to your thinking and to your policy development. And so we did. We took a proactive partnership-based strategy in order to build a strong and positive relationship with government, even though there were those of us in the sector who were very anti-government, wanted to have the fight. And this was about saying, look, we think they just didn't know, and it's time for us to be friends.
I'm recalling the interview that I did a year and a half or so ago with Carol Rasko, who in a former life was the domestic policy advisor to President Bill Clinton. And the thing that struck me in my conversation with Carol was her emphasis on, you know, when you're talking about domestic policy for an entire country, you make the assumption, which has been borne out in the ugly politics in the U.S. most recently, you sort of make the assumption that there's going to be pros and cons and people are going to disagree. What Carol said worked over and over and over again was that she walked into the room assuming she was going to find the point of agreement. Assuming that she was going to find the commonality. And that's what I'm hearing in what you're talking about, is you didn't look at that as, we need to go up against the government. We need to find those points of commonality.
When I look back at what has motivated and influenced my brain, it's funny. I remember going to a meeting in the basement of a church in my community and listening to a Latin American woman who came in to talk about the women's movement in Latin America. And the only thing I remember from this session was somebody asked her, what was the secret to this movement in Latin America? And her answer was, we only ask the question, what do we agree on? What do we agree on that we can move forward with? What do we agree on? And you know, I think if nothing else in my life, that has been the most critical question that has informed everything that I do.
Can you give us another example of where that question has guided progress?
Thousands of them. But I'll tell you a little bit about the organization, the Center for Social Innovation, because I think this thinking informs how we function and what we do. So what we do at CSI is we support social entrepreneurs. We start with a very basic premise of, how might we share? So at the very, very get-go, we're asking this question, what do we agree on? How do we opened our mind to all of the different ways that people want to be a part of the solution. And how do we create a fertile platform to support the cross-pollination and the positive work that will enable the next generation to create the systems and tools that I hope we'll see an even healthier and more vital and vibrant society? Mm-hmm. So I'll take you back just to be a little bit more concrete. At CSI, we welcome people who want to be a part of the solution. Now, you can imagine, you create a shared space for 350 social mission organizations. Lots of people are going to ask you this question. Well, how do they get in? Mm-hmm. What is social mission? Is one organization's social mission better or more important than somebody else's social mission? How do we prioritize? And does it ever get political? And this is one of my favorite questions, because, of course, where we come from at the center is to say, we don't believe that solutions are necessarily left or right. We don't believe that they are inherently political. We believe that they can be challenging problems that require a high degree of creativity and innovation to problem solve out of. But one of the ways that we've really practiced and embedded into our culture is this question of, we believe everybody can be a part of the solution, and it's up to that organization, that person, to tell us what they agree with us on. How do we put out that magnetic attractor, if you will, and say, we're here to be a part of the solution. How are you being a part of the solution? And this power of a person, an individual, opting in, seeing how their work, whether it's as crazy as an undertaker who's offering environmentally sustainable burial services, the way to an app developer who's developing a mobile app for obesity or diabetes management, all the way to a nonprofit organization that's trying to influence policy on urban planning, people are finding their own way in to be a part of the solution. And in the past, we simply haven't had the kind of platform which is open-minded enough to hold that difference. And that, I think, is what's happening and what's changing in the social change movement. It's about this broadening up, this opening up, this inclusiveness that's saying, we can all be part of the solution. How do you want to play?
The word that you keep using, magnetism, really is just resonating. I mean, that's how people opt in. They're being pulled in by something. What is that something?
Yeah. And I think that something is something different for everybody, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If you were to ask you, Hildy, what motivates you? It will be very different than what would motivate me.
Right.
And that's that diversity, that difference brings us back to that question. And what do we agree on?
Yeah.
Instead of getting stuck in what's different, what's wrong, how we differ, why you think we should take this position on this particular policy and I think we shouldn't. Really, we often get caught in the details without looking at that macro question. What do we agree on, and how can we work together to get that?
Right. That's Peter Block's book, The Answer to How is Yes.
That's right. Exactly.
I always love. One of the things that it really sounds like is at the core, and it's not something that you're stating explicitly, but I'm really hearing it, is that what initially will draw people is some sense that there is a core of principles, a core of values that is at the core of what the center is about. Mm-hmm. And if they're being magnetized by something, if they're being pulled in by something, there's a lot of places that just provide space. There's a lot of places that just provide shared space where a social entrepreneur can have a desk and have some Wi-Fi.
Yeah.
What is really at the heart of what you guys are doing is really a core of principles, whether they're expressly stated or not. But it really sounds like that is a big piece. I mean, asking people to opt in and asking that basic question of what do we agree on, that alone is an example of a core principle.
Absolutely. And we do have explicit values as well. And they're sometimes provocative to some, but our three values are very simple. We believe deeply in the power of collaboration and community. We believe deeply in the power of entrepreneurship and initiative taking. The third is around systems change. It's around not just treating the symptoms, but at looking at the underlying causes of why we're in the situation we're in and looking at how we're replacing the broken systems with vibrant, human, authentic, enabling systems.
What do people find controversial? I'm curious. You mentioned that not everybody agrees, or some of these may seem controversial. I'm curious what people might find controversial in these.
Well, look, the concept of entrepreneurship and of nonprofits becoming enterprising and being focused more on creating a sustainable business model often is challenging for old not-for-profit organizations that are still struggling with how to make that work.
Gotcha.
And in a Canadian context, we have and actually in a U.S. context, there's still a lot of government funding out there supporting the work of nonprofit organizations. Mm-hmm. And that is important, valuable stuff. But the concept of social enterprise can be a little destabilizing for nonprofits as they are struggling to try to figure out what that looks like for their organization.
Gotcha.
And I think that there's a sense also that there's this groundswell of young social entrepreneurs who are actually choosing the for-profit model, the social venture model, and questions of their authenticity, of whether it's a greenwashing or whether it's genuinely impactful. These are the kinds of
sure.
wonderfully challenging discussions we get into.
Well, they're wonderful discussions because they allow you again to respond to that question by taking it up to what all it makes possible.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And so, you know, when CSI looks at what we do, we come back to our four words. It's work, connect, create, transform. So what our magnetic attractor is about removing the barriers, about creating the workspace, building the relationships, building the capacity of these not-for-profits and for-profits to be able to create the organizations and the businesses and the initiatives that they are supporting with the goal of fundamentally transforming the world and real social impact. So it all comes back down to what do we agree on and how can we work together to replace the broken systems and start to replace them with healthy, balanced, vibrant, human-centered systems.
Well, Tanya, I wish that we had another half hour to talk about all of this because it's really at the heart of those really core values of what do we agree on and how can we work together to create change? How do we leverage the threats that we see into the opportunities that, you know, we always hear it's a threat if we think it is. And you know, so many people say, yeah, yeah, yeah. But you're really a living example of how that happens. Thank you so much for joining us. I hope we can check back in with you at another point and see how the center is doing.
It would be my pleasure, Hildy. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Back when I wrote The Pollyanna Principles, I took an entire chapter to focus on recommendations for community-wide infrastructure for social change efforts. I noted that our communities already have infrastructure for basic needs like police and fire, roads and utilities, and that we also have infrastructure for schools and libraries, for parks, for economic development. I invited my readers to then imagine the results we'd see if there was also infrastructure for the work being done to improve our quality of life. That's what Tanya and the Center for Social Innovation and other shared workspace hubs like that are providing to social entrepreneurs in their communities, an easy way to share resources and to convene around shared ideas. Sadly, as I listened to Tanya, I thought about how much those types of resources are just as needed for traditional community organizations, those groups who've been trying for years to find ways to break down silos that are often created by funders and other forces outside their control. And just as I did back when I wrote the Pollyanna Principles, I still long for community-wide infrastructure for convening, for resource sharing, for organizational support, for learning together, working together, brainstorming together, for leading the community together. Tanya is doing that. Not only in Toronto, but more recently, the Center for Social Innovation is partnering to bring its shared workspace model to New York City. And as she's done in every effort she's worked on, she is again asking, what do we agree on and how can we work together? Which leads to questions for your own work. As you participate in networking groups in your own community,
Are you using those groups for support or maybe social activities? Or are you asking the powerful question at every meeting, what could we accomplish together that none of us can accomplish on our own? What issues is your community facing that you might use as a magnetic attractor to bring groups together to create the future of your community? And if you're a funder or social investor, what are you doing to leverage your power to bring groups together to create the impact we all want to see? How are you ensuring groups have a shared space to come together around the things they agree upon? As you begin exploring these big questions, I hope you'll share your observations at the Chronicle's website, philanthropy.com, and at Creating the Future's Facebook page at facebook.com/creatingthefuture. We hope you've enjoyed this edition of Making Change. If you have ideas for guests for this podcast, folks who are driving new ways of thinking about what it takes to create visionary social change, please get hold of me through our website at creatingthefuture.org or on Twitter at Hilde Gottlieb. Thanks for listening and for wanting to create a better future for your community and our world. For the Chronicle of Philanthropy, I'm Hilde Gottlieb. We'll see you next month here on Making Change.